What's up, everybody? Today's episode of the Smoking Tire Podcast is brought to you by Valvoline, the original motor oil. That's right. I said original because Valvoline is America's first motor oil brand. For 150 years, they've been innovating, creating, and reinventing motor oil. From the first high mileage oil to the first synthetic blend to the first racing oil, they've never stopped pursuing innovation to maximize engine life. And their latest innovation, extended protection full synthetic motor oil, provides 50% better wear protection than industry standards and is 10 times stronger against oil breakdown. Valvoline extended protection is specifically formulated with dual defense additive technology, combining an innovative additive boosted with a fortified detergent system. Well, why do you need it? Because you're probably a more severe driver than you think you are. You might go on short trips. You might tow. You might drive in very hot or cold weather. You might have a turbocharged car. You might drive around in a fully loaded truck or van, or take your sports car on spirited drives. That all puts extra pressure on your engine. And people like Chris Forsberg, Rob Dom, Tavarish, Freddie Hernandez, Speed Academy, Gears and Gasoline, Dustin Williams, and TJ Hunt all trust Valvoline in their cars. I love Valvoline because their long history and their successes in motorsport give me the confidence that I'm putting a high-quality motor oil in my car. Valvoline is the only motor oil with a dedicated engine lab where they can run specialized and standardized engine tests right in their own facility. Valvoline is also the world's number one supplier of EV battery fluids, offering tailored products to help extend vehicle range and efficiency. Valvoline is proud to be the official motor oil of Hendrick Motorsports, and Valvoline driver Kyle Larson was just crowned the 2021 NASCAR Cup Series regular season champion with 9 wins and 2,000 laps led. Find Valvoline now at your local auto parts store. Ask for it by name. We are also brought to you by HelloFresh. I love HelloFresh. It is because here's why. It's not just for people who are bad at cooking. It's not pre-made meals that are going to taste like leftovers from the second they show up. It's pre-portioned fresh ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. So you can skip trips to the grocery store, which are annoying. You get new recipes to try, which that's one of the problems with cooking. Even if you love cooking, like I love cooking, you get stuck in a rut. You get 5 or 10 things that you like to make that are easy and don't take much time. And then you don't really want to get creative, partially because finding a new recipe is hard, partially because you don't want to have to buy some $10 or $12 spice that you're only going to use once. And that's why HelloFresh makes home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. You know what I mean? HelloFresh offers 50 menu and market items to choose from every week, including vegetarian, calorie smart, and gourmet options, providing plenty of variety that can help you learn and try new recipes. The ingredients travel from the farm to your door within a week, so you get the convenience without skimping on the quality. And it's not just for meals. Their marketplace features a variety of add-ons for breakfast, desserts, and even seasonal snacks like Pillsbury pumpkin cookie dough. It's a can't be beat value. Even at full price, it's over 30% cheaper than grocery stores. And with this holiday deal, it's time to try it for even less. So go to HelloFresh.com/smokingtire14 and use code smokingtire14 for up to 14 free meals and 3 free gifts. Okay, you got that? HelloFresh.com/smokingtire14. And then you got to also use code smokingtire14. And that gets you 14 free meals and 3 free gifts. This is awesome. It's a great deal. Got great fresh food for the holidays. Learn some new recipes, and then you keep those recipe cards for later. You can multiply the recipe and make it for bigger groups. It's awesome. I love HelloFresh. Thank you for a sponsor. Code SMOKINGTIRE14 gets you that deal. What do we got here? How about Talkspace? I love Talkspace. You know why? Because on this show, we are okay with seeking help for your mental health. I have been seeing a therapist for basically my entire adult life. And I was seeing a therapist in person up until pandemic. And now I see a therapist
virtually. But one of the biggest problems with a therapist is finding a therapist, you like. Where do you get the referrals, especially if you come from a background of people that don't already go to therapy and you don't have a friends group or a significant other that's already been to therapy to get a recommendation? That's why Talkspace is super clutch. It helps you make it possible to speak with a licensed therapist right from your phone, tablet, or computer anytime. And unlike traditional therapy, you can message your therapist anytime via text, video, or voice. It's 100% secure. It's stigma-free. Their therapists are licensed. They are professional. And it's really important to get involved with therapy. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm like a big, tough guy, right? I look like I would have been someone who stormed the Capitol. But I am secure with myself, and I have no problem with the fact that I go to therapy. It's judgment-free. It's the same kind of thing as going to the dentist or getting a personal trainer. And I love that Talkspace makes it easy to connect with a therapist privately, lets you message whenever you need to, because you're not always feeling like you need to talk at the same time every week. So having that flexibility is excellent. So Talkspace has all the benefits of therapy without the hassle of setting appointments, waiting a week or more between conversations. And if you've always wondered about therapy but you weren't sure where to start, Talkspace is a great place to start. It's private, it's secure, and whether you're struggling with anxiety, depression, self-doubt, or anything else, Talkspace gives you access to the help you need to move forward. So go to Talkspace.com, get $100 off your first month when you use promo code TIRE at signup. $100 off your first month at Talkspace.com, promo TIRE. Just check it out. It's very, very helpful. Talkspace.com, promo code TIRE.
And we are also brought to you by Ignite. Listen, all over the world, companies are getting hit by ransomware attacks and having their valuable digital files held hostage, being forced to decide whether to pay cyber criminals to get them back or to have them be lost forever. On average, it takes 23 days to recover. That's 23 days of disruption, downtime, and chaos. That's crazy, right? JBS, a company that supplies 25% of the nation's meat, paid $11 million to hackers to get back up and running. The cost of not operating was simply too great. The Colonial Pipeline billing system was compromised by a single leaked password. They paid $4.4 million, and it shut down the pipeline for days, causing crazy lines at gas stations all over the country and the price of fuel temporarily to spike. And even the entire city of Atlanta was effectively shut down for 5 days due to a ransomware attack in 2018. Ransomware can come for any company in any industry, but small to mid-sized businesses are going to get hurt the worst. They have fewer cyber defenses, so ransomware has more ways to sneak through. With smaller teams, these companies are usually slower to recover, and for these companies particularly, the downtime and reputational damage can be devastating. That's why Ignite is the first ever file system with sophisticated ransomware detection and recovery tools fully baked in. It lets your teams create and share documents using Microsoft 365, Google Docs, Slack, Salesforce, DocuSign, and countless others while keeping your company's data safe. Right? They've also got a great UI user experience. It's most security software is awful. Ignite is slick. It's easy. Teams will love using it. And ransomware detection and mitigation, they all run in the background, so your team can work without disruption, right? They've got total visibility, so you know exactly where key documents are and who has access. There's no on-site hardware needed or no on-site software needed. You can shut down compromised accounts quickly and identify and restore encrypted files, all from a single cloud-based platform. And it's amazing. It's great stuff. Ransomware attacks can be inevitable, but losing your valuable data is not. It's all about being prepared. So with Ignite, you won't need a specialized security ops team to keep up. The system is always learning and adapting to new threats, and your team can go about running your business like they always have, and you can rest easy. So see why Ignite is rated number one for data security by real customers in the G2 crowd. Learn how you can protect your business from ransomware by going to ignite.com. EGNYTE.com. Start your free trial today at EGNYTE.com.
All right, on this episode of the show, McKeel Haggerty is in studio. Actually, that's not true. He's calling in from his collection in Traverse City, Michigan. McKeel is in charge of Haggerty, the insurance, the media group, and everything. And we're talking about the collector market. We're talking about why an insurance company is an important place to be if you're trying to protect car culture. We're talking about some of his favorite events, what's in his collection, and what the future of car collecting might look like. McKeel Haggerty on the Smoking Tire Podcast. It's now a show. McKeel Haggerty from Traverse City, Michigan. What's happening, my friend?
Hi, everybody. Nice to see you. And, good to be here.
Thanks for the time.
Patience with the technical difficulties.
Oh, yeah. No problem at all. It's been a while. I've wanted to get you on the program for like months and months and months now.
Well, it's COVID, so we blew. Last time I saw you, I think it was right before.
Yeah. I think it was either at a Galpin party or in Vegas. I don't really remember where. Are you going to SEMA?
Vegas, I don't remember it at all, but it could have been a Galpin party somewhere. So, yes.
Are you going to SEMA?
I can't. No, this year, this is a really crazy time for us, so I'm having to sit it out this year.
Well, we'll represent on your behalf.
Thank you.
I'm a multi-point Haggerty customer. The shop here is insured by Haggerty, your commercial department. My cars are under Haggerty. And for a time period, I had a show on Haggerty. I'm going to put you on the spot for that one, McKeel. See by the make you renew us.
Oh, look at the time. Oh, yeah.
But Haggerty's in the last 2 years, you guys have really made some big moves culturally. The new magazine, pretty much hiring all my friends, which is great. hiring some very smart people, some of the most talented writers working today, and with a video team to boot. So, what happened in the last 5 years that made you and your team decide it's time to not be an insurance company anymore? It's time to be a media company now.
Thanks, and I appreciate all of that, and we've long been actually kind of in the publishing and entertainment business, especially from an informational standpoint. I grew up around the car world, in and around the car world. My dad was a hobbyist. You know, we always had car magazines. We were always going to car events growing up, and I bought my first car at 13 years old, so I had this like deep passion for automotive media and the great writers and all those types of personalities you describe, and the great publications. You know, to me, they weren't just publications; they were, they like had more heft in your life. You know,
yeah.
Road and Track came, or whatever the magazine was that you liked. We were a big Porsche family when I was growing up, so when Porsche Panorama came, it was like a. It's like an old friend visiting to the house. So I always been fascinated by that. And as we, we're really scaling the business, the insurance business. So there we go. Great picture.
Oh my God. Look at you as a kid.
Yeah. Look at my hair.
Wow. The hair.
The hair gone.
Who do you think, which bald men in this room had better youth hair? Zach, do you want to show McKeel my youth hair from I posted my youth hair on my Instagram yesterday. Oh my God. Boy, was I running the early 90s. You got to see this one. Your youth hair was really, really good. But scroll down. Look at mine. Here's me at 12 with my go-kart.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, you and I.
Look at that.
We were there. I was going for the full. We were both. Yeah, cut up a very similar cloth. I think I had the same go kart too. Before.
Did you have that? That was the Thunderbolt 2. It was called.
There we go. There we go. So anyway, we just knew that if we really wanted to be, a meaningful player in and build an automotive brand, where even though insurance. Was and still is the biggest part of our source of revenue, that the brand we really wanted to build was one where people understood that we're one of them. We love the car world, we love being part of it, we want to keep it going and growing and evolving and all that kind of stuff. So first we started kind of publishing a magazine. We started with like our valuation tools and doing seminars and all that kind of thing, and added video. And it really became self-perpetuating, which is the more you put yourself out there and the more you, we're working with great people like you talk about, the more you are showing up at great events.
and not making any excuse about it. It's just, you know, the name of the company's Hagerty, and we do all these different things. It really started creating these virtuous cycles. So, and sadly, you know, we're playing in one of the newest mediums in around the automotive world, just having a conversation, you know, over video and sound like this, is that the automotive publishing world's really been struggling, right? You know, the circulations appear to be going down, the magazines are getting thinner and thinner, the business models are tough. And we realized we could do it differently. You know, we could actually, you know, continue to produce really high quality content, you know, keep great quality publishing, and we don't have to make all of our living doing it. So we can afford to do it a little bit differently. And we're just having a blast. So that was the first piece. And then it's given us courage to say we really can be an automotive brand, and why not? Why not make it our own? Lots of other companies did. We're going to do it too.
Well, from the magazine perspective, you know, the traditional model of the, you know, the monthly print rag obviously is basically dead. Just there, but it's been sort of replaced, not only with you guys, but Road and Track has made this move, and the Road Rat out of England, one of my favorite publications, to do this sort of quarterly paperback coffee table kind of model, which I actually find to be really nice. You know, they let the photography breathe a little bit. They really are able to work with a more spacious layout. Mm-hmm. You know, the magazine isn't, you know, 75% ads. And I think that although their circulation is probably down, I think the enthusiasm for those types of publications is very high.
And we still think there's a place for print. You know, our Hagerty Drivers Club magazine, which you get if you're a member, you know, we have almost 800,000 members, I think, getting close to it anyway, that, you know, are receiving that magazine 10 times a year. And, you know, we feel it can still be done. You know, we really, like you said, we want to keep the quality of the ads high and keep the ratio of them down, so it doesn't feel like you're just kind of reading a, you know, like one of those grocery store circular things pick up for free. And, and you know, the challenge is once you start talking about that kind of circulation, like I think we're maybe the second or third highest circ car magazine of any kind in the world. The ads start getting a little expensive for the advertisers just because of the sheer volume of the number that have to be printed. So, you know, that's a challenge over time. So one of the things that may be exciting for, you know, you to hear is that for sure we'll be launching new publications in different segments of the car world over time, over the next few years, just so that we can kind of start getting a little bit more granular with audiences rather than to try to be a general purpose publication across the board. But, you know, I tell you what, we're having a blast, and I'm just so proud of their work, because I think the video content, I think the magazine content, the stuff we're doing is it's stuff I like to read. And, you know, and my first mission for like Larry Webster on the magazine side is like, first rule, don't let it suck.
Yeah.
You know, it's gotta be really
good strategy.
Good.
Yeah.
And then we're going to build from there. So,
well, and what you guys have, the one thing on top of talented writers and photographers that sets Hagerty magazine apart from the others is you have the database from the insurance company. Mm-hmm. So you can really, and what I love what Colin Comer does for the magazine in terms of tracking the values of collectibles. You've got that little, it's a one pager, but it's a buy, sell, hold. I love checking the buy, sell, hold every month. I love the bull market issue, which is the issue that shows, you know, what is the up and coming hot collectibles, not necessarily the most expensive, but models that have shown the biggest percentage of year over year improvement and stuff like that. And I think that's something as a, you know, not just an enthusiast, but a collector, you know, cars are expensive. I mean, you never, you know, it's almost impossible unless you're a certain amount of completely out of touch wealthy to separate a sports car from some type of investment. You know, we like to say, oh, you don't buy it to collect it, you buy it to drive it, and that's true, but you know, you'd like to get some of your money back someday.
It's more fun to drive it if you know it's not just hemorrhaging money with every roll of the tire.
Well, and I put it this way, is even if you are really, really wealthy, no one likes to be made a fool, no matter what you spend money on. You know, maybe some people just ignore it, you know, they don't care if people are thinking they're kind of an idiot. But I think even wealthy collectors are willing to spend money if they don't feel like they're being foolish doing so. And,
true.
You know, our whole model from the beginning, think our mentality at the beginning was insurance, which is so kind of protect, trust, kind of preservation of things, is that our whole approach underneath even creating things like those valuation tools and, articles like that is to say, let's make you smarter. Let's give you some tools to, make you a better collector along the way. Let's make it a safer place, because, we're fairly similar in age, I mean, my dad, would he be 87 if he was with us? It's like that generation, if you were into cars and you wanted to collect, especially anything that was not like right down the middle, sort of Corvette, Mustangs type stuff, the expertise was held in so few hands, mm-hmm. right? Like, there were, a handful of dealers, a handful of kind of auction companies, a handful of people, and it was opaque. Like
they were always talking about the book, but it was never like Kelly Blue Book. It was never a book that normal people seemed to have access to, was it? It was like obscure book that you were like, wait, what book value? What book are we talking about? How do I get one? And you never could.
Yeah. Well, anytime they said something, somebody would go say, hey, what's the value of a 39 Chevrolet? There is no book value of a 39 Chevrolet because they don't trade hands very often. And so, our view is just give people the tools to have fun doing this without feeling like you're going to get taken advantage of. And then, that was kind of the baseline. And now it's much more about entertainment because, big part of our future has been not just creating some of our own events, but we've been acquiring some events, mostly right now at the high end of the car market.
Didn't you buy Amelia Island?
We did. Yes. Yeah, we did. Yeah,
bought the, so. High, bought how the island.
How do you buy a car show? How does that work? Something I've never really considered before.
Well, there is a business back there.
I guess.
Unlike all of these, there's a business. Somebody runs it. Even if there's a big nonprofit element to some of these, there's there's revenue that comes in, and they're hard to put on. There's lots of volunteer work, and it's kind of thankless. And our whole view was, the purpose of our company, I'll come all the way back to the beginning, is our purpose is to save driving and car culture for future generations. It's not just, and the reason we're going to do that is we think driving is fun, it's good for us, and it's not about mobility. This has nothing to do with this idea of mobility that I'm trying to get to work as efficiently as possible. We know there's fun in driving and competition and status.
In fact, you specifically exclude mobility. You literally, I bought a Mach-E and I could not put it on my Hagerty policy. They're like, no daily drivers. Sorry.
Cool. For you, I might make that exception. So
no, you know what? You know what my agent said? She said, if you wanted to put a brand new car on your Hagerty policy, we could do it, but it has to be a proper enthusiast car. If I wanted to daily drive a Corvette or daily drive a 911, then they would do it, but they will not insure regular cars.
A Mach-E. Well, yeah. Let's not tell Jim Farley that it's a regular car.
If it's a GT, I'll try again. I'll reapply when I get the GT.
There you go.
But I think what's interesting is if your goal is to save driving and drive and car culture, doing that against the backdrop of insurance is an interesting way to go about it because specifically because of what happens if you get into an accident in a car that's covered by Hagerty. And I could speak to this from personal experience. My wife's Japanese van, someone hit it. It was in a minor accident. And if it was a regular old run-of-the-mill insurance policy, they absolutely would have totaled the van. But because the Hagerty representative who he worked with, who is lovely, I love her so much, understood that this vehicle is special, not because it's expensive, but because they agreed to fix it, and it wasn't necessarily a pure math problem. It's declared value or agreed value insurance. We agreed and we insure it based on this value. And it was under that. But a regular insurance company would have totaled this car 100%. And the car was mechanically perfectly fine. And we drove it around for a month and a half with the damage. All it really needed was a sliding door. But Hagerty agreed to pay what it cost to fix it properly. And so that keeps these collector cars on the road and keeps them from getting totaled unnecessarily, you know?
Well, and, you know, regular insurance company would often cancel you after something like that happened. You know, our view is that we want to keep you for life. You're still a car person just because you had an accident. We want to keep you for life. We want you back. We want a chance to, you know, make a little bit of our money back too. And canceling you does nothing. So, you know, we know you're a car person and car family. You're one of the luminaries in the space. Mm-hmm. And there
can
are
I put
a lot
that
of,
on a t-shirt?
Please, luminary.
Business card.
Luminary. Is, you know, that's the thing here is that we're thinking for life and we're thinking multi-generationally. And so our view is the chips we're putting on the table, yeah, in order to save driving and car culture is we got to build a big business. And, you know, that's going to have a lot of different elements to it to help us serve that mission. And, you know, we hope as people buy in, not everybody's going to love every single thing we do, but, you know, we hope we're going to put good people out there and have a blast doing this. So I'm having fun.
And it's about attracting the children of your longer term customers, right? Because yes. I think one of the hurdles that you guys are up against is convincing people in their 20s and their 30s that their JDM import, their E36 M3, their let's call it an entry level collector car should be treated like a collector car from yep. from an insurance perspective and not like a, you know, like a regular car, you know.
Well, think about something, you know, kind of entry level or something. I used to have one of them, a Fox Body Mustang.
Mm. So,
right?
My man.
Yeah. I had one in college, yes. You know, driving around Southern California, and mine was an 89, and you know, we have access to a lot of big data sets. And one of the things that we discovered was that there are over 800,000 Fox Body Mustangs still registered in the United States.
What do you know? What percentages of what were built? I don't know no, if that's
that,
a lot
I, you
or
know,
not.
I never went we back and looked at the build out. Numbers, but yeah. You know they're built in significant numbers. But you think about that. So
I get so excited about the future when I think, you know, 800,000 Fox Body Mustangs still registered in the United States. You know, these cars are owned for fun, and that's the future, right? Which is, you know, I love talking about Ferraris and Duesenbergs and whatever it is, but it's all of those cars that I want to kind of bring into our world and mm-hmm. say, you know, maybe whether it was insurance, whether it's events, whether it's publications, maybe you didn't feel the love before, but I hope you feel the love now. And yeah. That's what we're trying to create. So we're having fun.
Well, I think it's that level of awareness among the entry level collector that isn't. That, I mean, you guys are clearly making some smart moves, but when I talk to our fans about that type of thing, and whether it's a Fox Body Mustang or a late model BMW, that to convince them that those cars are worth actually insuring on Hagerty, dealing with the agreed value, which can be a little more expensive if you've just got one car, but it's all about what happens if you get into an accident, and you know your regular insurance company is so much more likely to total the car, not even because of how crashed it is, but, oh, well, it's hard to find parts or, you know, whatever. You got to get the parts from Japan. And that can really be a factor when it comes to fixing those cars, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. That's right. That's the you got to know all of that. I mean, as I was telling somebody today is that, you know, you can't go put a crappy windshield in a car that had a really cool, you know, original windshield in the car.
Yeah.
So you gotta recognize that's going to be really expensive, and that's yeah. okay because we love you and we want you back.
I had a friend who was a Marine, and he went to do a tour of Afghanistan in 2010, and he left me. He's good. He's fine. No worries. He left me his Porsche 944 Turbo to look out
yeah.
for, and no problem, right? Yeah, no problem. I'll look out for it. I took it out the first day. I made it about a mile from my house, and I was rear-ended at a red light while stopped, and it wasn't that bad, but all of those. That rear tail light assembly, the rear tail and the hatch, and those parts were almost gonna total the car. And we're talking about a low mile, nice, clean, you know, and this happens now. Once a car is out of production for a while, like these little hard to find parts could can cause a real problem, you know, so it's yeah. it's important to get that valuation right.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Is that because other insurance companies think just see old Porsche that they think is worth they don't really understand the collector market. They don't understand like the enthusiast market, and they don't really track that stuff. They're just looking at what the value is.
Yeah, and they didn't they looked in their book and they saw 1987 Porsche 944. They didn't have a thing for, well, it only had 20,000 miles on it. They didn't have a thing for, well, the paint was mint. They didn't they didn't have that way to really reality check what was in their book, you know.
They'll happily take your money. They're going to struggle with it on the other side. And it's nothing against them, because our whole model was, I don't want to compete against the big insurance companies. I want to partner with them. You know, so right now we have deals where we work with 9 of the top 10 insurance companies, for example, and just launched a new big partnership with State Farm that will go live next year. And something like in the first year, we'll get another 400,000 new members coming our way that will be handling their cars. And State Farm's never done a partnership like this, but they recognized kind of how far away different we were. And these are important customers for them, and they don't want to lose the whole customer. So they'd rather, you know, have us handle it. And then what we do is we'll handle the insurance, and then we bring them into the Hagerty Drivers Club. So they get, you know, the magazine, they get invited to events, they get, you know, valuation tools, they get all the cool stuff that we do. And then I'm not competing against State Farm. They're going to be a good partner. So
yeah. That's interesting. I don't hear about insurance companies like being willing to work together with each other. That's a new one.
It's kind of the future. We think it's kind of the future, and you know, we were kind of a pioneer in it. First relationship like this was 15 years ago. It's one of the reasons why we insure 2 million cars. You know, is that we've been partnering that way, and what we do is we take our membership model and really activate the person as a car person, you know, instead of treating them like some insurance policy or some number, is that they're important and we love their stuff.
What is, so the level of performance of the modern supercar over the last 10 years has really gotten out of hand. the level of performance that you can buy for even $60,000 or $70,000 or $80,000 is really, really gotten out of hand. I mean, $9.99 a month for a Hellcat, you know, is just ridiculous.
Don't worry, Matt. Everybody's judgment has also gone way up.
Right.
Too,
yes,
right?
Of course. Our driving ability is way up. Our attentiveness is way up.
Every junior high has a fighter pilot program. Yeah. And we all graduate and then we get our driver's license.
What is do you have any thoughts towards, me and my friends talk about this a lot, and I think it's totally unrealistic, but a tiered licensing and insurance system based on additional training and maybe even the capability of your car?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting. You know, I remember, stepping back to an earlier example, you know, who doesn't love Cobras, right? You know, real Shelby Cobra, but, you know, how many replicas were built? I think at one point there was 142 different manufacturers of Cobra replicas. And, you know, for not a lot of money, and you put a great big crate motor in an 1,800-pound car, and you now have a really dangerous car.
Both Zach and I, Zach owns one now, and I owned one in the past, and they are death traps.
So, you know, We had 4 fatalities in 1 year, in them, and every single one of them in replicas. And every single one of them wasn't the owner. It was the owner said, "You got to take this thing for a drive."
Oh,
lost
the
keys to a friend, and the friend wiped it out. You know,
and they
perished. It was sad. And I remember thinking to myself, like, we probably ought to stop insuring Cobra replicas, and then, or could we at least say, well, insure them, but you got to go to driving school or something, or you know, some way to sort of lock it down. And you know, we haven't quite gotten there, but what I've been amazed at is, you know, you look at Hellcats. I think there was this breakthrough year, and it was when the Shelby Mustang, I think it was 2013, came out with that
the 660 horse supercharged
motor. Not a lot of money, when, by the way, even a Viper didn't come to that kind of power until, you know, except for maybe an ACR or something.
No,
like
the ACR stopped at 640. Mm-hmm. Even the most powerful ACR was 640,
Well, there you go. And so, you know, here you got this fairly inexpensive car that is really fast. And by the way, they kind of sort of held their value. So, you know, for 30 something grand, you could buy a 660 horsepower car and, you know, a couple years old. That was a game changer. And then you add the fact that all of the big luxury car manufacturers who used to build hundreds and maybe very, very low thousands, you know, suddenly started ramping up production. So think Ferrari, you know, think of the Bentley Continental, right? You know, that incredible twin turbocharged V12, you know, that was really expensive and they depreciated a lot. And suddenly
yeah,
35K. Of them.
Yeah, 35K right. You're getting in like a 06 Bentley GT, you know?
Right, or one of the, you know.
Or Nissan GTR. Yeah. You know, the Nissan GTR, I think, is really the flick of the switch where we're talking about twin turbo, all-wheel drive, dual clutch gearboxes. And from there, the performance of these cars just shot through the roof, you know.
Yeah, so if you're looking at the history of cars, back when, you know, a Bentley was a truly rare thing, or a Ferrari was a truly rare thing, and now they're throwing out 7,000-8,000 of them a year.
Yeah,
like so you're just, you know, where I grew up in northern Michigan, like you didn't see Ferraris, you know, you didn't see Rolls Royces, you didn't see things. And now, you know, you live nearer it than I do, you go to Beverly Hills and it's like,
yeah,
you know,
now we don't even look at them twice. Right. I mean, literally, my office right here on Centinela Boulevard and Centinela Avenue in Playa Vista, you know, it's I can hear that V10. I hear five or six of those V10s a day screaming by. You know what I mean? It's a very identifiable noise.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's an R8 or a Lambo, you know, I all day, you know, and they're not like obviously common if you go to, you know, the middle of Nebraska, you're not going to see them. But in a major city, you know, these are production cars now. And yes, and they're being driven by people that are not necessarily racing drivers. And they have an extraordinary amount of performance.
Yeah. Well, they've gotten easier to use all the time.
Right.
So maybe before, you can speak to this, McKeel, like your clients that had these performance sports cars, Ferraris and whatnot, they had to be really interested in either the image or invested in the driving because they weren't comfortable to use, they weren't easy to operate, they broke down a lot, or the AC didn't work or whatever. Yeah. And so it was
you had to give something up.
You had to give up a lot, you know. Yeah. And now you don't have to give up anything. You have Bluetooth, dual clutch, all that stuff. So everyone is showing up.
Well, and you know, think of a Lamborghini, you know, under Audi, you know, Volkswagen Audi ownership, they run. the windows go up and down. Yeah. Everything works. And so you have you kind of have, as people say, kind of German reliability, unbelievable looks, whether it's your thing or not, and unbelievable performance and really hard to handle. It's a concern. Well, it's great. We live in a new gold, from a car perspective, we live in a new golden age of performance, way better than the muscle car era, like dramatically better than the muscle car era. But it comes with some pitfalls because we've really exceeded the ability of a lot of driving skills and certainly public roads. And so, you know, I remember when the first C7 came out, I had just bought a new 911 C4S, and Chevrolet found out I had the C4S, and they kind of said, hey, we want you to test out the new C7. They sent it up to me in northern Michigan and like, hey, go ring it out a little bit and see what you think. And I'm like, where? I'm like, where the heck am I going to do that? You know, like, I'm going to hurt myself. I'm going to run over somebody's dog. I'm going to wreck the car. You can't test one of these modern cars at their limit except on a track. And I'm probably not a good enough driver to really get the last little bits of differences out of them anyway. So super exciting. And, you know, one of the reasons that people have been asking, why are we making so many moves into motorsports lately? You know, so many sponsorships, so many, you know, we bought a couple of companies around the motorsport space, is really what we're trying to do is it's more about autocrossing and track days and, you know, not wheel-to-wheel racing, but just to get people to say, look, it's fun to drive fast, but let's do it in the right place. Let's go get some instruction, go to a track day, go to, you know, we sponsored, you know, the SCCA's Track Night in America kind of thing. And I don't care what
that's a good event. I like that event, the Track Night in America thing. It's like a lower priced sort of intro to track days kind of thing where it's not a whole day. It's like a couple hours in the afternoon or evening. I like that. That's nice.
Well, and that's, we're just trying to do a lot of that. We think actually, you know, that's where people should want to go. And if you want to buy a cool car that's got, you know, just a whole ton of performance, go there. Just go there, you know, just don't try to do it on Mulholland like I did in college.
Well, we got people up in the forest where we, you know, where we film, and there's a safe way to enjoy a car in the Angeles Forest. There's a safe way to enjoy a car in Malibu, but there's people that take the opportunity to explore the limits of adhesion on those roads, and eventually, you know, they end up on their roof or they end up on the side of a cliff, yeah, having to get younger, scraped off.
Inexperienced, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and with the newest, you know, whenever I drive a new McLaren, I have the same thing that I say to McLaren and to my audience, which is just, they let you just buy this. Like, right. You know, yeah, you can get a Hellcat for $75,000 and that's a lot of power, but a McLaren is like, you know, even just in the new issue of Road and Track, Performance Car of the Year, sorry to talk about a rival publication there, McKeel, but Travis said the new McLaren 765 LT laps Lime Rock a second and a half faster than a McLaren Can-Am car. A car known for being so scary and dangerous that they don't exist anymore. And this 1,800-pound, and that you can buy a car with air conditioning and a license plate and a total real amount of usable, daily drivable comfort, and it's faster around the track on street tires than a Can-Am car on slicks, and you need no training whatsoever. You just need money. You right. just show and up with money, and that's
the,
it.
The problem is that the new cars make it feel like that speed is accessible. Like, yeah. Oh, we fixed all of the stuff that made it crazy before, yeah. And now it's easy. It's yeah. like because the acceleration's easy, but the physics don't change.
Yeah.
So if you go towards that corner on a public road or in a track or whatever at, you know, 40 over what you should be, yeah. like, you can't rein that back in. And yeah. that's the mistake people make.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my first car, that 911, you know, I remember the first track day I did at 17 years old. And, you know, I think I knew how badly a 911 of this era could, you know, swap ends.
Is this the 911 you know, we're looking at? The red one?
Yeah, that's it. That's yeah, it.
It's very pretty.
You know, and there I was pirouetting into the grass, you know, on my very first lap. And I'm like, oh, so that's what you mean by don't lift.
Well, that's what you
know. Yeah.
But that made me think of, that's what's so great about the autocross or the track experiences that, you know, you guys support and other people do, is if someone has not had an accident on the street and then they go to a track day or autocross and the car spins on them or understeers, it sticks in your brain like, oh, that's how quickly it can go wrong. And they weren't trying to drift. They weren't trying to like become block. So when they go back to the street or the canyon, hopefully they recognize how quickly the consequences can change.
Yeah.
You know, like you learned on this track, like, oh, that's what they meant. And yeah. thankfully yeah. you didn't have to learn that next to a field.
Yeah, I kind of think in a way this is, you know, I think drifting is super cool and can, you know, the videos, what could ever be better? But, you know, they've kind of sent this image of what it means to take a corner in a high performance way. They've set a weird image for people, you know, like, you know, when I grew up, learning to take a corner was about, you know, finding apex and carrying speed. And, you know, it was just sort of a different animal. And now I think kind of the new generation thinks that, you know, the way you're going to show off and take a corner is like this full drift around it.
Okay, cool. Boomer, whatever. It, good luck. Fine, good luck. Old man.
Yeah, good luck.
You suck. No. That and the Japanese toge videos, you know. I mean, but yeah. look, drifting's really fun. I mean, I've done it on tracks and skid pads, and it's really fun. The reason I don't do it on the street is, A, I feel like a sense of I have the fear. It's the reason I'll never be a great racing driver. It's the reason I'm not like a motorsports, because I can see the consequence. I have a self-preservation thing, and that's why I don't explore the limits of traction on the street. Other people don't have that. There's people that just don't. They don't have that, and they just go for it.
Website of people leaving cars and coffee, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. What is, you know, to where I started this conversation with mass-produced supercars and very high performance? Are we seeing, from your perspective, a proportional number of those cars getting written off and wrecked out?
Oh, yeah.
What is the most wrecked sports car according to Hagerty Insurance?
Well, let's see. During the financial crisis, it was Lamborghinis. Now it's McLarens.
Yeah.
So
I would have guessed McLarens. They're rear drive. They're very light. The turbo shove, likely to enter a corner way too hot because they're so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're have you driven any of the very fast EVs?
You know, I'd really love to. No. So the answer is, you know, straight up no, but I can't wait. And, you know, I was in a, I was in a Taycan Turbo S yesterday. I don't know if that's considered
that's a fast.
Fast
yeah, that's, yes, yeah. That's a very fast EV.
Impressive.
Yeah.
Super fun.
Yeah.
Super fun. But
when
I
you're,
own one of those.
When
I
you're
don't.
On a windy road with the difference in EV driving is very interesting because you don't have auditory or vibratory or gear selection in which to judge your corner entry speed. And these things are so fast that you can really enter a corner crazy hot and you can end up in trouble.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we did a photo shoot last year in that Tale of the Dragon, Larry and I did, and I was in a 600 LT, you know, courtesy of McLaren. And one of the things about Tale of the Dragon as a road is that a lot of the corners are marked at 15 miles an hour, not 35.
Yeah.
Like they are tight.
Yeah.
Tight.
Yeah.
And it actually is kind of a good thing because you don't have to go super fast around them to feel like you're kind of like right about at the limit. And, you know, we had dinner with the guy who has the kind of unofficial record. It's not a racetrack, but, you know, there's a whole group that times themselves. And, yeah, there's the photo shoot right there.
Yeah, it was raining.
It was wet.
And it was raining.
You
didn't
mention 600 LT in the wet is not an ideal choice on
exactly.
Trofeo R tires.
Well, we did get a couple of passes through there when it was dry. And then, you know, now we have these nice moody shots to show how crazy we were. But, you know, what we were, you know, hypothesizing with the guy who's current record holder of making it through all those turns. And, you know, we said, you know, what's probably the easiest car to go through there fast in? And he was saying probably a Porsche Turbo S. But he said,
that makes sense.
You know, right now, you know, right, because they're just darn near flawless in so many ways.
They're bananas. The new Turbo S is I don't want to say it's dangerously fast because I don't believe it's dangerous. It's easy to control, but like, it's bananas how fast those things have gotten.
They're really good.
They're wild. Yeah.
And you don't have to. You don't have to be, you know, Pat Long to bring, you know, bring out a lot of performance out of it, and that's what's pretty amazing. But, you know, he was hypothesizing that look, the right electric car is going to take that time because, you know, the ability for instantaneous torque out of those really tight corners, there is no substitute for the torque you're going to get out of a couple of electric motors.
Yeah.
What
Volkswagen ID4.
Like, what did that guy drive?
Yeah. Or not ID4, the one that set the record at Pikes Peak. Like,
oh yeah.
You know, they dropped the mic and it's going to be there for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that guy was a McLaren driver. I think he had a 720S is what he said.
Yeah. I mean, if you are a very good driver and you have a 7 series McLaren, There's just no one's going to catch. I mean, I brought a 720S to a track day, and I'm not anything special, but I was passing 5 or 6 cars on the front straight at Auto Club Speedway like I had a Game Genie cheat code going on. I mean, it was absurd. It's absolutely absurd.
So let me ask you a question. You guys really know this world, and I have this hypothesis that the genius of the modern McLaren, you know, since they kind of relaunched, you know, talking post F1.
Right.
Were they trying to pull an audience away from other manufacturers or did they create a new one? That's what I've been, I don't see the pure McLaren driver as, I mean, maybe they were a Ferrari driver before, I'm not really sure, but it feels kind of like a different audience to me.
I think as an example of them pulling away other drivers, I was listening to CJ Wilson on a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was, you know, hitting some success with baseball, he went to the Ferrari dealership and he wanted to buy one. And they looked at his record and like, well, you haven't owned any of these before. They didn't want to sell it to him. So he went down the street and went and bought a McLaren. And now he owns like 3 McLarens and a P1. And
a McLaren dealer.
And a McLaren dealership.
He owns a McLaren dealer.
So he's someone who was pulled from that existing market.
Okay.
Yeah, and the McLaren drivers that I know now, and this is fully anecdotal. One came out of a Ferrari, another came out of a Porsche, and I don't think they've created an entirely new market, but I definitely think they raised the bar and they made the other companies catch up a little bit in terms of what they're, I mean, you know, I don't think Ferrari would have necessarily gone turbos if the McLarens weren't so much faster. I do think they've really done a good job of bringing that Formula One nerdery to their road cars better than some of the other, you know, brands have.
Yeah, they have.
You know,
high engineering standards.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that whole, like everything about them they're super cool.
The engineering is very crazy. It's right on the, you know, they're so crazy that they break themselves going so fast. You know,
they shake their windshields apart.
Yeah, they literally break themselves apart because they're so on the edge, you know.
What else is in your collection, McKeel?
I was kind of a mixed bag. I'm much more into event cars now that I can use for different events. So, I bought a Speedster last year because, we acquired an event called the California Melee, which is a 1,000-mile drive with, you know,
it's hilarious,
really early interesting cars. So bought a Speedster, didn't have one.
Acquiring events is so 2021.
Oh, yes. I did buy a really vintage car this last year. I bought a 1928 Bentley 4.5 liter.
Whoa.
And it was an original condition car. So, you know, I like some pre-war stuff, but it's got to be pretty special now at this point. I'm not really interested in building a collection. I'm interested in just having stuff that I can use in the right spot.
So, love it. I love that.
You know, bought a, I restored, there we go. You know, kind of like that. Mine's not a Vandeplas, but it's, kind of looks almost identical to that one in the upper right. And that's a super cool car because it's just like, you know, I think about this history of this 90 whatever year history of this thing and the gentleman who owned it and drove it all over the world, and that kind of feels cool.
Is that a fun car to actually drive?
It's the most challenging car I've ever driven because they were very challenging transmissions. So like you get in and it's right hand drive, center throttle, so the throttle's a little button in between the clutch and the brake.
Yeah.
And so you kind of like, it's like you have this zen moment when you're getting it running and like thinking about driving because you know you're double clutching, and the synchro pattern kind of requires double clutching differently when you're going up or down. So you're like, and so when you go from first to fourth in this thing and make, you know, three clean shifts, it's like you're like, yes, it's the best day of my life.
Yeah, so cars of that period before they like standardized inputs is when you really kind of.
Well, there's all these little adjustments you're making on the dashboard. My wife refers to it as me driving a typewriter. So
that's funny.
It's really funny. So, and I just, but part of it is, you know, for us saving driving, or like I love talking about modern supercars. I'm kind of in between a modern 911 right now, so waiting on what's next is. You know, for me, I want to preserve the muscle memory of making sure people think it's fun to drive really vintage stuff too, as well as some of the great newer cars that you can buy. But I restored an Aston Martin DB4 a couple years ago. That's a fun touring car. I have a Demon, you know, as a modern car. We were a launch partner of the Dodge Demon, and that's fun to go out there and scare the pants off of people in. So I don't know. I like all sorts of stuff. So,
yeah, it seems like have a car that kind of, they're very different flavors. There's not a lot of overlap, which is very cool. There's not a lot of redundancy there.
That's how we think.
I just love kind of trying on all sorts of stuff, you know? So, you know, I'm always in search of something that's going to create a cool, neat little experience. You know, we have a Duchesneau in the garage, you know, why not? Crazy
little
French.
So many good things about those.
Yeah, they're cool.
So bad.
Yeah. What are your plans for the California Melee? Is it just because that's a really nice event? It's gotten very big over the last 7-8 years. What do you plan to just kind of let it continue on as it was, and or is there a big plan for it?
Well, it was created by a man, Martin Swig, and managed by his two sons for the past couple of years, David and Howard, you know, wonderful stewards of this event. Now, these are cars that were all eligible for the Mille Miglia in Italy, the Mille Miglia Rally. So it's, you know, really vintagey, 1929 to 1957. And we're going to keep the format of this pretty similar and just keep moving it around California. What we'd love to do is perhaps add a second or third event that opens it up to slightly different category of newer cars, so that's a little bit more accessible.
There's not enough events for my Countach. Can we do an 80s melee?
Well,
I'm serious, McHugh.
Yeah.
I'd like to do an 80s one. Well, those cars are old now.
Maybe you and I can figure that out.
Yeah.
So we'll figure that out. So, you know, for me, it's just keep having more fun and make these things as accessible as possible. Bring more kids into events. You know, we just ran the Greenwich Concours, Greenwich, Connecticut last week, and we changed the format of it. We said, hey, Sunday's a Concours d'Elegance, great cars, generally pre-war, some post-war. But on Saturday, instead of doing a two-day Concours event, we did Radwood. We had on the field at once, we had Radwood, so 80s cars. We had Concours de Lemons, which is lemons. And then we had and then we had Porcella. I don't know if you know Porcella. It's, you know, it's kind of modified. You know, thanks.
It's a good name.
Emery.
It's a good name. I like that one.
Yeah, so that was fun because it brought out families and kids and, you know, a lot of humor, lots of laughter. And I think we needed that. And, you know, I had this family come up afterwards and like, greatest car, the Saturday, they said, greatest car event we've ever been to. Can't wait to come back. And I'm like, we win. We did it.
Nice.
We nailed it. So
I like that location too, that park in Greenwich. I grew up like right around the corner from that park. So I know that park very, very well. We used to see bands in that place.
We took all the vendor tents down and now all the cars are along the water. So you get, you know, you get pretty views.
That's a good idea.
Great cars out there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The idea of you have to get to a certain level of collecting where you've sort of done everything else and now you're buying cars for events. That's like a real, that's a real top tier of collecting. And I think there might have been an article about it in the most recent Hagerty magazine, or might have been Sports Car Market, but it was pretty much like the premium events around the country and like what type of car would guarantee you an invite to the Colorado Grand or the Mille or one of those.
Oh, I have a car that I bought specifically for the Grand because I had so much fun in that, which is my probably most dangerous car. It's a 1958 Bocar XP4, which was
a what?
Bocar, B-O-C-A-R.
What the fuck is a Bocar?
In Colorado. Looks like a Maserati birdcage.
Holy shit, look at that thing. Yeah, Bocar SPA?
So. Mine is the, it's called the XP4.
Bocar XP, wow, it does. It's like somewhere between a Maserati birdcage and a Lister Jag, maybe.
Yep.
And
yeah, in that realm. So
it does look very dangerous.
Yeah, that's my number four.
Wow, that's a nasty looking thing, huh? What kind of motors in that?
100 pounds, 327, 440 horsepower.
Whoa.
Oof. You know, I think the brakes are made out of veal, which really is exciting.
There's a lot of ways to die in that car.
Dude, it's cool looking.
No, it's cool.
Wow.
So, like, that was a Grand car that I bought just because there were so many truly great cars, but that I could never afford. I thought,
look at
gee,
it. Ooh.
What's, you know, yeah, isn't that a great profile on that
what
thing?
What a great
profile. It's a good-looking car.
Cool
and
headlights.
Is this, I've literally, you've stumped me with this one. I've never heard of a Bocar before. Is this a... without even being too specific, is this more affordable than other kind of Grand entrants?
Oh yeah. These are, you know, you can, there have been a few for sale. Let's see. I bought mine from the restorer, but you know, I've seen a few of them sell for like $300.
Okay. So not cheap, but cheaper than a Speedster or a Gullwing or, you know, or a lot of
the
other.
Like the cheapest ways to do these events would be in a Devon.
Oh yeah,
another one that people don't know. Another kind of one of those American specials, you know, kind of beat up car with a big motor. You know, Bocars are a little more rare than a Devon. Devon's probably a better car.
I think the article kind of talked about even some almost production level cars that just had like race history. Like you could buy like a. Like a Fiat that did the 24 hours of Le Mans, you know, if it and it wouldn't be enormous money like an MGA, you know, even if an MGA has Le Mans history, no one's spending $400,000 on it. You could get into it for a much more reasonable price. And if it's got an interesting enough history, you could be accepted into one of these events.
It's like a Miata that won the TC Challenge.
Yeah.
So, you know,
much more affordable.
10 years
ago. Yeah.
Well, but let me tell you the craziest event eligible cars of them all. And those are the London to Brighton cars, the oldest oldest car event.
Yeah.
So I have a 1903 Knox that we bought to be able to do the London to Brighton because
I believe
for
it's
years
KNOX.
KNOX, made in Massachusetts. And
yeah, so, it's like an ox cart with, is it have a tiller? It's a tiller, isn't it?
It's a tiller car, yeah. And it has this little tiny porcupine single cylinder air cooled. And I describe it as, no, that one in the upper right is way too refined. Mine kind of looks like kind of like your grandmother's desk. Yeah, like that. Yeah,
is
there
it,
we go.
That's, is this a 3-day event?
The
that
tillers are really
miles.
Hilarious. That seems so sketchy. Yeah.
It's wow. 62 miles in one day, and it was the celebrating an event that happened in 1904, and the newest cars are 1904. So it's 1904 and older. And I think it took us, we made it in record time for us. We made it in just under 7 hours, and 12 hours is not uncommon.
So how exhausted are you by the end of this 60 miles? Is the most tiring 60 miles of your life?
Oh, and the best beer you've ever had at the end. The best beer ever, I can tell you. It's cold and it's usually rainy, and you know, you feel like it's like a total victory, and then you have a pint or two or four.
Do they close the roads for this? Are you on public roads?
No, and so what they do is, apparently this was what happened back in the day, and they've been doing it. Like, some of these cars, by the way, in the event have done it 60 and 70 times, because they've been going on so long, is they start at like 6 a.m. So like, I think by the time, and it's 500 cars. So like, by the time we got to the starting line, it was like 7 a.m. Sunday morning in London. So there's not a lot of traffic. And you cruise around, and you go by Buckingham Palace, and then you kind of start weaving your way outside of London. And as more Sunday morning traffic is coming out, everybody's so amazed, they kind of give you room because you have no brakes. The car's going 19 miles an hour, wide open. And then you get out in the country, and it's just a blast. Yeah, there's a whole auction, you know, circuit. Like, if you look at some of these cars, of London to Brighton eligible, because there's no reason to own one of these cars other than to do that.
Do you leave this thing in London? Does it live in London?
Oh, yeah.
You just leave it over there. That's the move.
This is probably a hoot.
I bet there's a whole storage business in the UK just for these.
Because
people have to be totally international, right?
It's the best. It is so much fun. And I can tell you what, you know, we were talking about going fast in McLaren's, going 24 miles an hour downhill with one of these. You're like,
you're really going to die.
Well, I was like, I'd kind of be in this almost like pounce stance, because, you know, I'm thinking like, the only thing that's going to help me survive if something goes wrong is my cat-like reflexes. You know, I'm just jumping free of this thing and I'm out. You know, you're just going to be out. So,
what can you get a London to Brighton eligible car for? I mean, are we talking like 20 grand? Are we talking 100 grand? What does it cost these days?
Oh, 100 to buy you. Well, I mean, you can spend as much. You get a 40-horsepower Mercedes, it's millions. But, you know, like, you 60, 70, you can buy a good car, you know, 80 maybe.
Okay.
And by the way, it's a permanent market. So,
right.
You know, you buy one, you got a buyer for it right away.
Right. So, what was the youngest driver you saw on this event?
Do 16 you see years old.
Oh, really? Okay, cool. All right. So that's promising.
Because there's some of these families that have multiple cars, and it'd be like, hey, there's my grandfather, my father, and then the granddaughter, all three
that's
of them
driving cool.
separate cars. So
I'd
awesome.
Like to try that. It's a minimal time commitment. I think that'd be fun.
Yeah.
It looks they do a whole car show at the RAC, Royal Automobile Club, in London the day before, and you get dressed up, and it's just fun. Super fun.
I bet it's
Put
great.
It on your bucket list. Put it on your bucket list.
In February, I'm doing, in theory, if it happens, the Dubai Melee, which is new event, and it could be interesting. It was supposed to be in December. They bumped it to February. They say they're going to be providing us with vehicles, and, you know, who knows?
What
it could be fun.
What
they told me something old in Italian. That's all they told me, old in Italian.
What could go wrong?
I know, right? Yeah. In the middle of the desert, like, yeah, what could possibly go wrong? Indeed.
Well,
that's
I did the Mille Miglia rally one time in a friend's car, and it was the very first Abarth. So literally the first car that ever carried the name Abarth, 204A's chassis number.
So it was built like a prototype Italian car, is what you're saying?
Yeah, it was 1 liter. It was like tiny, and I'm not a tall guy, and like, I drove for, you know, 4 days like this, and it didn't have, of all things, it didn't charge, it didn't cool, and it didn't have synchromesh second gear, which is actually the only gear you need in the Mille Miglia. So it was, and all I remember is my dear friend at the end, he said, did you have fun? And I'm like, Yeah, that was kind of a way to describe that.
That's hilarious.
Well, do you want to do it again? And I just said, you know, I think this car belongs in a museum. It's just a little too important for anyone to drive.
I'd like to do it in a Gullwing, please.
Exactly.
You know, something that's
you
comfortable.
Hate the guts of Gullwing drivers because you're in this thing and they just kind of go silently blowing by you and you kind of envision them listening to classical music and sipping tea.
Yeah.
You know, as you're just like grinding it out and something.
Yeah.
So.
I had like a 20-minute go in a Gullwing once, and I came away from it going, I could actually daily drive this car. Like, it was the easiest old car to drive I've ever driven. It was
amazing.
People
don't have any idea how great those were. I mean, those were so far ahead of their time. They're crazy.
Yeah.
They're just crazy.
I mean, even like a 356, a well-sorted one, that's probably the second nicest driving old car I've ever driven.
Yeah.
A Gullwing is so far beyond that. I mean, it's amazing how easy it is to shift and rev match and how precise the steering is and how comfortable and quiet. It's like, you're shocking how nice they are, even 50 years old. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. Do you have anything on your, like, kind of, you know, obviously you're a man of access and resources, but is there anything that is on your dream list that you've not been able to afford or buy yet?
Yeah, you know, a couple two eras of cars, just to throw them out. You know, I've gone on record before saying I'd love a 289 Cobra. I have a 67 GT500 that I've had for years, and it's fun, but I'd love to have a Cobra. And I like the small blocks just because I think...
Because you're smart.
I think the Britishness comes out in them a little bit more. Like, it feels a little bit more like a car that I recognize rather than a Corvette. Then I'd love a 959. I would love to have a 959. Like, you know, just two different eras. Just throwing them out. Not saying it's a complete list.
No.
Those would be a couple that I would love.
Jeff Zwart told me that, you know, he owned a 959, and he told me that even, you know, he bought it when they were, you know, 200 grand and sold it when they were deep in the seven figures. And he said, even despite that level of appreciation, the maintenance bills would absolutely horrify you because it's all unique parts. It didn't share like anything with any other car. And, you know, it's just nobody can work on them except Canepa and, like, you know, two other people. And he said that the bills would make an F40 owner blush, which is
okay. Well, you scared me away. Now, I did drive one of Canepa's full-blown SC versions.
One of his crazy ones. I haven't, but I hear they're insane.
850 horsepower.
Yeah,
and he kind of fixed all the oddities.
Yeah,
you know, changed the wheels. You know, they look identical to the originals, but they're just the different size. So, modern tires fit on them. You know, kind of got rid of some of the weird suspension, adjustable suspension stuff, you know, changed out the turbos. They're so good. It's so fun. It drives like a 911 until all 850 horses kick you right in the tail. So much fun.
I did have a go in Bruce Meyer's Yellowbird, which is extraordinary. And I got to drive it up in the canyons too at speed. And that was, you know, it looks like a 911. But it just doesn't. The engine doesn't feel like any other 911 I've ever been in. It was just absolutely magnificent. Alloy roof knows exactly what he's doing. Yeah,
that's a blessing.
Number one roof Yellowbird number one. Unbelievable.
God bless Bruce Meyer.
Oh, he is a G. Yeah. And I just went to the Peterson. His Porsche 910 is on display. I didn't even know he had a 910, but it is hot. Yeah. It's very hot. McKeel, we've got a few questions from our from our Patreon audience. Do you have a few more minutes to share with us?
Of course.
All right, cool. Zach, you want to pull those up for me? If you want to watch the live streams or have an advertising-free experience or ask questions of us and our guests for the show, patreon.com/thesmokingtirepodcast is how to do it. Very affordable, and you get lots of extra things. Brandon Smith says, McKeel, what is the most impressive private collection you have seen? You don't have to out the person by name, but if you want to give us a sense of what that collection was.
Well, you know, a couple of collections that actually people can see, and just because there are a couple that I'd love to mention, but it really wouldn't be right to mention, but... you know, truly what Miles Collier and the whole team has amassed down at the Revs Institute in Naples It was a museum that closed down for a long time, and now it's open kind of by appointment only. And I strongly recommend anybody anywhere near Southern Florida, take the time, make the appointment, go over there. Such an incredible history of American racing heritage, like stuff that people can't even imagine, between the Cunninghams and the Le Mans winning 917 and, you know, all of this stuff. It's so cool and it's so well laid out. Like, just go do it. Another one kind of like that, that really was somebody's private passion that's on public display, that I find fascinating. And a similar theme is Fred Simeone's collection in Philly. So it's extraordinary. And, you know, you think about it, here's a neurosurgeon who's just passionate about cars, probably making a little bit more than the average guy back in the 60s and 70s. And back when these cars weren't worth anything, he spent his doctor money on amassing this collection. And it's just so extraordinary. You know, it's kind of breathtaking when you go in there and realize what's in there. But, and there are many more, you know, I mean, I've seen, you know, some of the, you know, it's fun to go see, you know, some of the pieces, like, you know, Bruce Meyer's garage and some of the others. But, you know, I love the ones that, where they're not totally private, you know, where people are willing to at least open them up a little bit. You know, there are a few collectors out there that do background checks and no one gets to see them. And I don't know. I kind of struggle with that.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I've been to the Revs Institute. It's amazing. I haven't been to the Simeone collection, but next time I'm in Philly, I definitely got to make a stop there. You know, the Black Hawk collection in Oxnard is open as a museum, and it's extraordinary, the kind of stuff that you can see there. That's worth a drive. And I've had the privilege of going into Ralph Lauren's private collection in Bedford, which is, on top of the fact that it's, you know, Ralph Lauren is widely known for having some of the craziest, highest dollar stuff out there. You know, it's the only place, I think, outside of McLaren headquarters where you could see three McLaren F1s in one place. You know, all the cars are on 8-inch risers, white risers with 5,600 Kelvin daylight balanced light boxes. Oh, I mean, it's like, it's the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen. And there's photos online. You can see, you know, what it's like. But that kind of stuff, which, where the cars would be enough on their own, but then you have this, you know, the kind of presentation that only Ralph Lauren, you know, can pull off, you know. So that kind
really
of stuff
extraordinary.
It's amazing. And it was cool that he toured those cars around to art museums for a while. I mean, those were some of the highest attended exhibits in the history of the museums that they were at. It was really, really cool.
I kind of feel like the best private collectors, I love the fact that even if they're very private, they still recognize that these things have public value anyway, and it's not about them hoarding them away, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I love. You know, Ralph certainly is private. Not everybody gets to go through it like you did, and but it's the fact that he does put the best of them on display is important.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's not free flying them over to the Louvre or whatever.
Yeah. That little documentary they made about getting them into the Louvre was crazy. They had to do some real, you know, it was like getting a couch onto the fourth floor walk up in Soho. You know, it was like they had to do some real finagling to get those things into the museums. There's helicopters involved. I mean, it was nuts. Yeah, it was really nuts. Prashan Panicker, what do you think of the classic Vespa market? Do you know anything about them? I don't really know anything about the classic Vespa market. Do you know anything about the classic Vespa market, McKeel?
Yeah, you know, it's really popular in some circles. And, you know, we insure a lot of classic Vespas. You know, a lot of them, you know, there are actually a couple of different kind of Vespa markets. There's some that kind of come with these kind of heavy custom, the mod thing, you know.
Yeah, the Quadrophenia really with like a dozen mirrors coming off the thing. Yeah.
And I think that's kind of cool. And then there's just, you know, there's outright, you know, just collectors of them. You know, the way I always kind of think about it, you know, for a lot of people who are into motoring stuff, you know, scooters, motorcycles are a great affordable way to start. You know, and still, like, for motorcycle, I mean, I've ridden motorcycles all my life. And, you know, but nobody just starts with a Vincent Black Shadow or something. You know, you start with a Triumph, or you start with a, you know, BMW, or you start with something like that. And that's what's fun. So
I just saw a Black Shadow. There's a Black Shadow in the Audrain collection. They have a Black Shadow there. It is very, very cool. Yeah, I wasn't old enough to know about, you know, to be there when the Vincent Black Shadow was the thing, but just to look at one up close and to see the technology, that a lot of which doesn't really show up until bikes that come from like 10 or 15 years later. You know what I mean? For me, yeah, the coolest motorcycle is the Honda CBX. Inline six, 1,000 cc, and uncorked. It just sounds like an F1 car. I mean, that is just, that's crazy town. I love a CBX. Yeah, look at that. Look at the headers. The 6x2 headers. I mean, that's just super fire. And to circle back, I don't know anything about classic Vespas, but I'm extremely pro Vespa in general. McKeel, you know I ride a Vespa 300 around LA. That's my daily runabout. Yeah, the 300's the really fast one. Does 85 miles an hour, and it's a fabulous vehicle. And they have a floor. They have a brand new price, and then you buy one with like 1,000 miles on it for 60% of that, and then it sits there forever.
Right.
I love a Vespa like that.
Well, you be careful at 85.
We're good. I wear the gear. The problem with Vespas is you have to resist the urge to go shorts and flip-flops. You know what I mean? We're not in Bermuda. We're in Los Angeles. Right. You know, so I dress up like I'm on a motorcycle when I ride my Vespa. Alan Johnson wants to talk about the new Z06 just announced. It looks awesome. The motor seems like gearhead gold. I have a feeling this car will turn Woodward Avenue into the Mulsanne Strait. Is it a future collectible? Your thoughts, McKeel?
Oh, it's collectible right now.
Right
now, just like every C8, you know, that came out. And just like the last C7s, I mean, almost all the C7s. Corvettes are still the most collected car in North America. All of them, every single one of them, you know. So, by the way, there's some great affordable Corvettes for people who want to get into sport, you know, sports cars, you know, great ways to go. But the this next Z06 is going to be nuts.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
You know, well, and if you follow their track record, this one's going to be so good that some of the big mid-engine European cars are going to have a hard time.
Yeah.
Well, Corvette has always, what they've done is they've democratized what the Europeans were doing well, right? So in the 50s, you know, or the late 50s, you'd look at what Ferrari was selling, and they took elements of that and democratized it. And then, you know, they did stick with the front engine formula long past when the Europeans kind of moved away from it. But now, you know, you could say probably the best Ferrari of the modern era was the 458 Speciale, where it had big power, lightweight, no turbos, dual clutch. And that is so clearly the benchmark for this Z06, where it's naturally aspirated, flat plane crank, smaller displacement than we're used to from a Corvette, dual clutch gearbox. I mean, it's so clear that they said, let's start from the 458 Speciale and move forward from there without going forced induction, you know, or hybrid, which they'll have one of those later. You know, I think that formula, now that Ferrari no longer does it, and Lamborghini is announcing that they're moving away from natural aspiration, you know, GM says, okay, well, we see an opportunity to commit to a naturally aspirated Revy, you know, powertrain. Mm-hmm. And I follow, you know, obviously a lot of car people on Twitter. One of them posted an email from a big time East Coast Corvette dealer. I don't know if it was Kerbeck or one of those guys, but it was one of those big, big dealers. And they said they have 1,100 orders at one dealer for the Z06. And they said it's a 4-year waiting list at this point.
Oh, I'm sure.
That's crazy.
Well, think about it this way, you know, to our questioner there, is that basically this is General Motors, this is Corvette blowing a kiss to the future collecting market. You know, because this is so good, it's going to be so great. Every single one will be collected, and everyone will be owned in, you know, Corvette loving hands for decades. So,
well, what about the fact though that I don't know? I've always sort of been of the opinion that the best Corvette for collectors is either a 67 to 69 or a split window, or the newest, fastest, highest performing one you can buy. And then in the middle, it's sort of, they just sort of kind of start to feel like old cars. And Jack Baruth, a digital editor for Hagerty Magazine, when he was at The Truth About Cars, wrote a phenomenal piece called the Cars That Are Never Bought, Sold, or Driven, which is a really, like, every used Corvette is, like, perfectly babied and has no miles on it. And I think that's a really interesting article. But there is kind of this middle ground, because GM, unlike some other manufacturers, Porsche, will build and sell as many as they possibly can. They haven't ever really figured out to build one less than the demand requires, you know? Do you think they figure that out, or do you think that this car is just going to be so great that that doesn't matter?
Honestly, that's a great question. I always feel like they, maybe not with the base level models, through the years, have they known how to restrain themselves, but I think they knew as they went through the typical, you know, call it Z06, maybe Grand Sport, maybe, you know, ZR1. I mean, if they make a ZR1 version of this, good heavens.
Well, that's going to be the 1,000 horsepower hybrid with the front wheel drive electric motors. They might call it Zora or something, but that's going to be that. Yeah.
Well, and how exciting will that be? And all of them are going to have to have.
You think you've seen some crashes now? you think you've seen some crashes? Wait till the Corvette has 1,000 horsepower for $150,000. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, here we go. So it's, I don't know. It'll all be fascinating. You're right. I mean, probably being a little more scarce on demand, I think, would be a smart. You know, the best of these aspirational brands know how to create scarcity.
Yeah.
And then they don't waver from it.
Yeah.
When you think of and that you want wait lists, you know, you want them rare, you want unique color combinations.
Just whatever Rolex is doing, just do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, think about in that extreme level, you think like, I think if I saw one more one-off Veyron towards the end when they were trying to sell them, and then they come out with the new car, and they just sell out like crazy, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, which I found kind of surprising. Or you think of the, you know, the Ford GT, you know, where you could tell like they almost became like old Ford when they released it slightly, you know, extended.
The Mark II.
Is that it would have been pretty easy to say, well, we're just going to kind of keep building them. Maybe that would have been pretty easy to do, and I'm glad they didn't. So.
Yeah. On that Bugatti thing, I just got the new issue of the DuPont Registry, and there's two full pages of Bugatti classifieds. Huh. I mean, one magazine, and there are 12 Bugattis for sale right now, in one publication. I mean, they made too many Bugattis, straight up. And we drove the Chiron. The Chiron Pure Sport is an unbelievable piece of hardware. No points against to those engineers. But there are 12 Bugattis for sale right now in one magazine. There's too many goddamn Bugattis. That's a problem.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, I think you're in that 959 problem, though. Especially with the Veyrons, you know, service.
The maintenance. Yeah.
A killer.
Killer. The $25,000 tire changes.
Well, the Veyron, after a certain number of miles, they had to take it apart and like split the shell in half. I remember reading that and I was just, what?
Yeah, it's crazy. So.
Yeah.
Super crazy. Two more, and then we'll let you go. Yeah, John Paredes. He has I don't know if I agree with his sentiment here, but I'll read it. What is the outlook for internal combustion classic cars in a future where everything goes electric and major cities won't allow internal combustion engine cars? I don't think we're at the point where American cities are banning internal combustion cars. They may restrict the sales of new combustion passenger cars, but I don't see a world where you can't drive your classic car into a city in our lifetimes. Do you, McHugh?
No. Well, not in my lifetime. I mean, I'm 53, so this is decades away, and you're right. This is how it's going to work, okay? The world is telling you that the world is going, or the modern car industry is telling you everything's going electric. And it reached a tipping point about whether we're ever going to ask the question of whether truly electric cars are like absolutely better for the environment and whether we're ready for them or not. You know, you think of disposable batteries, you think of the amount of energy that goes into producing the cars, you think about the outright disposal of the cars, and then finally you realize the fundamental problems that we have with the grids out there. You know, if even 25% of the cars on the road in LA County were electric cars, the grid would collapse. They can't run the air conditioning.
Yeah,
it would. I mean, there's just,
no. I 100% agree with you. I live in this town. I know how hard it is to put power in even one building project. It's not
well,
happening.
They can't run air conditioning. You can't run air conditioning when it's hot, when everybody's got the air conditioning running. So, but here's the deal. It's going to come in cities. This is what our questioner asked first, you know, and it's going to come in places like London, and it's going to come in places like Paris. It's one of the reasons why McLaren and others are, for example, doing hybrids, which they said they would never do, is that you need to have an all-electric mode for the 10 miles that you're going through the cities. And then when you get into the suburbs, you can light the car back up again. We're going to be in an environment like that for decades. Like you said, first, they're going to restrict the sale of new internal combustion engine cars. Great. 2035 seems to be the year that you're hearing a lot of that by a regulatory standpoint. It's going to be at least a couple of decades after that where you're going to see, you know, like more restrictions outside of cities. People often talk about, will fuel be a problem? Fuel will become more expensive. There's no doubt about it over time, but you know, I always benchmark the fact that it's $10 a gallon in London today.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people,
we're so spoiled here. We're crazy spoiled. Yeah,
crazy.
Spend a week road tripping Europe and then come back here and complain about $4 a gallon. We don't know nothing here. I mean, it's crazy.
We don't know nothing.
Yeah.
So I think you know, you're right. The world is going electric. Electric is cool. The high performance versions, like we talked about earlier in this discussion, are great. The grid isn't ready for it. And we're just going to be in a long time, probably most of the lifetime of every listener here, where there's going to be this kind of share the road model, and we're going to have to figure that out. So, you know, for us, our job is to save driving and car culture. And if more cars become electrified, I don't care. I just want to make sure you can actually drive them, you know, with your hands on the wheel. So,
yeah, well, I'm with you there. And I don't personally see even the harshest regulator. I don't think that even the harshest, most environmental, most progressive regulator sees a world where, oh, the real problem is actually vintage European sports cars that, you know, come out on the weekend. The real problem is classic, you know, muscle cars that drive 1,000 miles a year. I don't think that any reasonable person believes that collector cars are really a significant problem. I just don't see that. And so I think even if we get to a point where many of the passenger cars get legislated out of very dense city centers, I feel like there's got to be exemptions for vehicles built, you know, before a certain year that are up to a certain state of, you know, tune. You know what I mean?
Well, and we're going to be right there helping to make that happen. That's what we're here to do, is to make sure that you can keep doing it. I think you look at all these big companies also, not, you know, think of Delta Airlines committing to a carbon neutrality model. What that's telling you is not that planes aren't going to emit, you know, any kind of greenhouse gases. It means that they're going to plant trees or do carbon capture or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to have better and better carbon capture or credit models that actually work and that really are a net gain for the environment. And we may have to do some of that. You know, you may have if you want to enjoy a vintage car, you may pay $50 a year or $30 a year or something like that to carbon neutralize.
Carbon offset. Yeah.
And, you know, my view is bring it on.
Yeah. That's not that big of an inconvenience. You pay the cost to be the boss, as it were. Last question real quick, and then we'll let you go. Dan Mosqueda wants to know, do you ever envision Hagerty leaving Traverse City? What is it about Traverse City, and why are you all the way up there?
You know, I was born and raised here. Thank you. Born and raised here. We were headquartered here. I think we'll always have a big presence here. We have about 1,000 employees here. But it's, you know, like every place, you know, it's kind of hard to find enough team members to fully satisfy what we need. So we have other locations. You know, our media business is in Ann Arbor, and we have a big service center in Golden, Colorado, and Columbus, and we'll have more of them around the country. But Traverse City's home and I'm not leaving. So, you know, we're going to have something here and a big, big thing here for a long time. But, you know, one of the things we're also super excited about, we have a new business that we've been working on that we call them Haggerty Garage and Social, which are little member hubs that, you know, are going to have some cool activities in different cities around the country. And I think we'll be locating more people in smaller offices and where there's a lot more car fun. So it's fun up here too, but it's also cold in the middle.
Yeah.
Of
here. Yeah.
So
I think you guys should do a Haggerty, like a Concourse in Traverse City. Cause I hear it's so nice in the summer and it seems like the kind of place that would be a good for like a full town takeover, like they did at the Audrain or like they do at Amelia Island.
Only if you'll come.
I would come. I actually really do want to come. I've been invited by several of your people, and I really would like to find a reason to get up there. It seems like it's really nice in the summer.
It's lovely. In the summer. February, not so much.
Yeah. No, that's okay. I don't need the snow. McKeel Haggerty, thank you very much. Everything you need to know about Haggerty, you can find it at Haggerty.com or on their YouTube channel. And if you're if you have a second or third or fourth or 10th car and you're paying for regular old insurance on that car, you are definitely doing it wrong. I can't tell you how many people I've been like, you know, if you switch your collection to Haggerty, they understand that you only have one butt and six cars and they insure you accordingly. It makes a lot of sense. Thanks for your time, McKeel. I really appreciate
it. I'm sorry for all the technical difficulties, but thank you for the kind words, and I really enjoyed the conversation, and I'll make sure I just use the mobile phone next time.
It's fine.
We'll have another conversation.
All that stuff will be edited out of the final product, so the audience won't even know it ever happened. But thanks for your time, and come see us next time you're in LA, won't you?
We'll be out soon. All right.
Take care.
Thank you.
That's our show. Bye-bye. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.